All right, so last time we essentially concluded the Newtonian discussion of the Euler equations and radiation transport. And so this time, just to finish up this first or the second chapter, say, on the basic equations of computational fluid dynamics, I wanted to also discuss, obviously, the relativistic version of those equations, so the relativistic version of Euler's equations, of the equations of hydrodynamics and also of radiation transport, since many of us are actually interested sort of more in the relativistic, general relativistic in particular setting, rather than the Newtonian one. So I'll have to wrap up this today because we really want to start with some numerical methods next time. And so what I'll do is just give you a very brief summary, sort of very brief sketch of the relevant sort of equations with some details, obviously, for you to read up on or to fill in yourself. So this is just meant to be sort of a quick overview, as essentially the rest of this chapter has been so far. So as a starting point, let's just start with special relativity. So this is something most of you have certainly seen before. So in special relativity, we can summarize Euler's equations and the equation of continuity, so mass conservation, in the following form. So this is the continuity equation. And so in this chapter, now that we're working in space-time, Greek indices always denote space-time sort of indices from 0 to 3, while all the Roman indices, et cetera, go just label the spatial dimensions 1 to 3. So this is essentially our continuity equation, and then energy and momentum conservation is expressed in terms of the energy and momentum tensor, T mu nu. So here we're just looking at the special case of an ideal or perfect fluid that we discussed also in the Newtonian context. So we're going to neglect sort of non-ideal aspects, so meaning energy fluxes and anisotropic pressure, so anisotropic stresses and so on. So we'll just look here at the perfect fluid case. Many other things. Also, I'm going to neglect magnetic fields here. We could do the same discussion with magnetic fields as well and do general relativistic MHD. Everything will just look a little more sort of complicated. We'll have to carry around all sorts of additional terms due to the magnetic field, and it would just sort of overcome unnecessarily sort of make things sort of more confusing. So what I'm going to do here is just the Eulerian way, with sort of the MHD case being very analogous. And in principle, you can just read up on this or do the derivation yourself with the starting point for the energy momentum tensor, including magnetic fields, and then also with the general relativistic induction equation. Okay, so with an ideal fluid, so in a local rest frame, we have no energy fluxes and so on. We can write this tensor as h rho h And so here, H is 1 plus epsilon plus P over rho, which is the specific enthalpy. And so this is the Minkowski metric. And so I'm pretty sure you've sort of all seen this. Now, in general relativity, now assume that sort of the space-time is given, and we have some background metric g mu nu, we can essentially invoke the equivalence principle and then sort of transform these special relativistic equations into the general relativistic version. So we'll take the special relativistic version and then apply the equivalence principle and if you want to call them sort of substitution rules if you wish. So essentially, we have to replace the partial derivatives by covariant derivatives. And the Minkowski metric by the actual spacetime metric g mu nu. And so now this is obviously a sort of a very hand-waving fashion. And you can sort of construct so all the sort of special relativistic sort of scalars, vector fields, and tensor fields will be mapped to their corresponding GR versions essentially by invoking these local normal coordinates. So which is essentially the exponential map. So some of you who have taken the GR course last year will actually remember this construction. So we looked at this in quite some detail. The exponential map that essentially exists for any Lorentzian manifold where you sort of can project the, locally project the tangent space onto the manifold itself, and there's an isomorphism between the two. And those coordinates actually provide the so-called Riemann normal coordinates, which are essentially the sort of mathematical formulation of the equivalence principle. And so this is how you can essentially construct locally from essentially the Minkowskian setting in the tangent space and sort of those fields there, you can construct a local GR version of this. So anyways, assume that we sort of have some background space time, we can write down the GR versions now of these mass conservation and energy momentum conservation equations. So also according to these substitution rules, the energy momentum tensor will be will look very similar. And now here we have the space-time metric g mu nu. Okay, And so the purpose here is really not to discuss the derivation of these equations, but the goal here is really to now analyze these equations a little bit, and to bring them into a sort of more familiar form and a more suitable form for numerical evolution. Because really what we have to do here now is to transform this into an initial value problem. So as you can see here, these equations are equations on our four-dimensional space-time. But what we would like to do is to have some initial value problem formulation by which sort of given some initial data at sort of some spatial slice at some initial time t, we want a recipe by which we can advance this initial data to a next time step t plus delta t. So we need to sort of reformulate these equations in a way that is more suitable for such computational purposes. And so the key here is essentially to foliate space-time into hypersurfaces, which will then give rise to a foliation essentially of these equations that, as you will see in the end, look like these conservation laws that we've been discussing so far. So in the end, we can essentially boil down these tensorial equations into conservation laws that look fairly similar to, for example, the Newtonian version, with some additional complications that make it actually tricky in practice to evolve these equations. But at least on the formal level, they look actually very similar to what you've seen before. And essentially, this will be the punchline of this part here, to show that we can reduce this into a suitable initial value problem. So we really want to rewrite those now. In conservation form. So that we can actually use the same techniques as in the Newtonian case, or say similar techniques. As I said, there will be additional complications, but sort of at least on the conceptual level, it will be fairly similar. And so this leads us to what is called a 3+1 decomposition of space-time. And again, here I'm only going to take a lot of shortcuts and do it in a sort of fairly hand-waving and ad hoc way in the interest of time. I know that some of you obviously know this construction and know some of the details about this. Some of you may not. So in the reading list, I've specified some literature that should help you sort of understand this from different angles. We don't, unfortunately, don't have the time here to go through this in detail and explain sort of all the details behind this. So I'd encourage you, if you're not familiar with this, to sort of look this up yourself. It will not be critical for anything that's to come in this in this lecture course. And so this is why I'm not going to go into more detail here. But for anyone interested in general in general relativistic simulations, I mean, this is a fairly foundational part that you should be aware of, and you should have some basic understanding of. So, just sketching essentially the very basic ideas here. So, as I mentioned, the idea, if I just draw this in sort of 2+1 dimensions. The idea is to essentially foliate space-time into a set of hypersurfaces. And so those can be defined as level sets of, say, some scalar function that we call time. So let's say we have some scalar function phi, and that we define just to be essentially our coordinate time t for now. And we keep this very general as for now. And we can call the level sets of this function. So essentially all the rest of the four-dimensional space-time on which this function phi is constant. We'll call this sigma t as these hypersurfaces. So this will be, for example, sigma t plus some delta t at some later time, t plus delta t. So here we'll have our coordinates x1, x2, x3. And in principle, we can define such a sort of congruence of observers, or essentially such a function, such a field phi, essentially by essentially specifying the tangent vectors. So a vector field, integral vector field, partial t. So partial t will be essentially the tangent vector to these curves. And so we can decompose this vector into a component that is normal to these hypersurfaces, so to these level sets of the function phi. And we'll also have some component that's orthogonal to this, so that actually lies within these level sets. So let me try to draw this here. So let's say this is the normal vector to these hypersurfaces, n. And so then you can decompose this here. And so this would be actually down here, we'd have a contribution beta mu, the so-called shift vector. So this part up here would be essentially beta mu if you want. And just for naming conventions, this is called the so-called lapse function for reasons that I'll explain in a few minutes. And as I already mentioned, this vector here is called the so-called shift vector, where we assume that it is normal to the normal vector. And so essentially, with sort of these conditions here, we have essentially four independent degrees of freedom to specify such a tangent vector field, such an integral vector field, partial t mu. So we have the lapse function, which is a scalar, and then we have the shift vector, which has four components, but there's another condition here that reduces it to three independent components. So in total, we have four degrees of freedom here. That essentially that specify this foliation, and therefore that specify these coordinates. And so this is essentially linked to the diffeomorphism invariance in GR, so the freedom to choose coordinates. And so what will be important is the following definition, that observers that have a four velocity mu nu given by these normal vectors n mu. So those observers that always sort of whose world lines always are normal to these hypersurfaces, So they don't move with respect to the coordinates. They always sort of go into the normal direction. And this is why they're called the Eulerian observers. Which you essentially can think of as, as a lab frame. Which essentially was also always essentially the frame that we were looking at the hydrodynamic equations in the Newtonian setting. So this is no motion with respect to the spatial coordinates, always in normal direction. Okay. So this is essentially the basic idea. And now we essentially want to formulate the problem in such a way that we specify some initial data on, say, this initial hypersurface sigma t. And then we need some recipe of how to advance those data to the next hypersurface sigma t plus delta t. And this is essentially where this will go. So, and therefore we'll choose what is often called adapted coordinates. So we'll choose for now, some Cartesian type coordinates where we identify this partial t vector, this tangent vector to our scalar function phi as essentially 1, 0, 0, 0, and then can identify the shift vector just having sort of spatial components beta I. And from the definition above, we'll immediately see that we can represent the normal vector n mu as 1 over alpha. Minus 1 over alpha beta mu, or written down in this component form, and one can then also see that the covariant version of this is so the covector is given by the following components. And again, just using basic definitions here, one can find the following representation of the form metric. So by definition, we plug in the vectors associated with the coordinate directions into the metric tensor. And what we'll find is the following. So G 0, 0 is given by minus alpha squared minus beta squared. Here we'll have the shift vector. And then here the spatial part is gamma ij, which is essentially the spatial metric on these hypersurfaces sigma t. Or if you're sort of more, if you like the representation in terms of the line element more, so it will be minus alpha squared dt squared plus gamma ij exi plus beta j dt dx j plus, beta j d dt. And so just wanted to write down, because so far alpha and beta are still sort of generic. And I just wanted to point out that, you know, a specific choice of those will define specific coordinates. So these four independent degrees of freedom specific choice of coordinates, or gauge if you want. And the tricky thing actually in actual simulations, when you perform hydrodynamic simulations in full GR spacetimes, the tricky thing will be how to choose those. So there's obviously there's very simple examples. So one of the most easiest things you could think of is just to set those to constants and say, well, okay, let's just choose this lapsed function to be one and the shift vector essentially to vanish. So let's set this to zero. That's actually known as the so-called geodesic gauge. I'm skipping some details here. You can read up in the notes if you want. So why that is and why it's actually called geodesic gauge. It turns out that some of these simple choices simply don't work in practice. So it turns out you have to adjust alpha and beta on the fly. So as you evolve the equations and as you compute solutions to the equations, depending on the solution, you will have to change and adjust the lapse and so-called shift vector. So for your numerical evolution to sort of stay well-posed and to make codes not crash. So that's actually a tricky problem, but I will not sort of dive in more into sort of the initial value problem in GR and 3 plus 1 decomposition here. As essentially this is not the main point here. So now let's look in, I should pause here real quick and see if there's any specific questions so far before I sort of write down the hydrodynamics equations. Okay, so if not, then I'll continue for now and show you how the equations of mass conservation and energy momentum conservation can be written down in such a sort of sliced way, if you want. So according to this foliation, now let's also split some of the fluid quantities here. So we'll essentially split now the fluid four velocity and its four momentum into, again, sort of a normal and a spatial part, or sort of a component along the Eulerian observer along the normal direction, and one component projected onto these hypersurfaces. So we can write down the four velocity field of the fluid, so U mu. as one component, again, in direction of the Eulerian observer along the normal direction of the hypersurfaces. And then one component that lies in the spatial hypersurface. So W here is defined as the Lorentz factor between the Eulerian and the co-moving fluid frame, so between the Eulerian observer and the fluid. So this is the projection of the four velocity onto the four velocity of the Eulerian observer and mu. Okay, and this vector here, v mu, what is often called a three velocity, then has components just according to this definition of ui divided by w plus 1 over alpha beta I. So remember, this was the definition, essentially the component of minus and I, the ith component of the normal vector. So let me see, I can try and essentially our four velocity will have some again, some will be some vector, some four velocity vector mu, and there will be a component again along the normal direction, and then will be some component v mu, which we call the three velocity in this hypersurface. Okay, so with this definition, we can go on and also decompose some of the other quantities, so the four momentum, for example, and so make the following definitions. So for one, we can define the Eulerian energy density, which is the projection of T mu nu onto the Eulerian observer. So this is E plus P W squared minus P. So I will not do the actual derivations here. I will just give you essentially the result here. But you can either verify yourself or read up on it. This is essentially just to sketch the idea and the derivation. So here we have the momentum of the four momentum of the fluid projected onto the spatial hypersurface. So we use the spatial metric to project it. And so this will be given by E plus PW squared VI, where VI is the free velocity. And so finally, the stress energy as seen by the Eulerian observer. So this is the projection onto again, the spatial hypersurface. So here we use project both indices. And this is rho h w squared vi vj plus pressure times gamma ij. Okay, so essentially just written down words, this is the total energy density. Momentum density. And stress energy as measured by such an Eulerian observer. Okay, so we have essentially now adapted some of the fluid quantities to this foliation. And using those definitions, one can essentially obtain the following form of the hydrodynamic equations. So first, let's look at the mass conservation equation. Continuity equation. And so plugging in using the split of the four velocity up here and a few identities, we'll end up with the following equation. Oops. And you can already see, so this is a fairly familiar form to us. So I should say that D here, capital D, is rho W. So this is the rest mass measured by the Eulerian observer. So this is the rest mass, and then you have the Lorentz vector here. So this is the rest mass measured by Eulerian observer. And as you can already see from this conservation form of the equation here, this is actually what we would then call the conserved density. So this is one of the conserved variables. And so V tilde is just a shorthand notation for this quantity here, that is often called the advection speed. Okay, so let's look at the some of the other equations. So let's look at the projected momentum equation. So let's project the, look at this projection here. So we take nabla nu t mu nu and project it onto the Eulerian observer. So along the normal direction of the spatial hypersurfaces. So essentially projection of, so the conservation law along Eulerian observer. And again, after some algebra, So it would take me a long time actually to go through these calculations. There are lots of algebraic steps in between, and since it is not really essential for the rest of the course, I'm skipping these steps. And so I'll just write down here the final form. And here you see that we have source terms on the right-hand side. So-called geometric source terms in this case, because you'll see space-time quantities appearing here on the right-hand side. So here we have, for example, the extrinsic curvature. Of these hypersurfaces that essentially characterize the embedding of these spatial hypersurfaces in the higher dimensional, four dimensional space-time. Also, we see here that there's the lapse function here on the right-hand side and so on. So here clearly space-time quantities appear on the right-hand side. But interestingly, there are no time derivatives of these space-time quantities, which is good. So we can actually, for the purely hydrodynamic problem, we can treat them as source terms on the right-hand side. So this is the projection along the Eulerian observer along the normal direction. And now we can also project the energy and momentum conservation equation onto the spatial hypersurface. And this will provide us with the momentum equation. So if we follow these steps here, again, there's more or less lengthy calculations. But then again, we find an equation that is of this conservative nature. And as usual, I mean, all the repeated indices are summed over, obviously. Okay, so again, here we have geometric source terms on the right-hand side. So this is the momentum equation. Here we have the energy equation. And the first one obviously was a continuity equation, so mass conservation, or more strictly speaking, baryon number conservation. So with these forms, we can actually write this now as a hyperbolic system. So in conservation form, again, we can write this as a system of this type, where the vector of conserved variables u is given by square root of gamma. So this being the determinant of the spatial metric gamma ij. D, and then the spatial momentum vector Si, and tau being the total energy minus the rest mass energy. So we'll define tau. I'll comment on this in a second, as the total energy density minus the rest mass energy density. And this is essentially to obtain the correct Newtonian limit of the equations. So if we were to go into the Newtonian limit. And so the fluxes are of this type. And we have tau v tilde I plus p vi. And finally, the sources are given by following expression. Here we have again the extrinsic curvature contracted with the spatial stress energy tensor. Minus sk partial k logarithm of alpha. And then so in principle, the exact form of these geometric source terms here doesn't matter too much for our purposes here. But the only important property to note is that there are sort of no time derivatives of space-time quantities appearing in these equations. So let me just make a few comments here. So this is essentially our hyperbolic formulation in conservation form. So the energy equation is written in terms of tau actually instead of E. To obtain the correct Newtonian limit. So let's just see how this arises. So let's see if we have tau minus d. So according to the identities above, we have this expression here minus p, and then we subtract minus d minus the conserved density, so the rest mass density as seen by the Eulerian observer, which is the rest mass density rho times the Lorentz factor W. And so in Newtonian limit, the pressure can be neglected with respect to the rest mass energy density. And so we can write this in the following way. So this is rho w times w minus 1 plus rho epsilon w squared. And so remember that h is 1 plus epsilon plus this p over rho, and we just neglected this p over rho term here in the Newtonian limit. And so if we write this out in sort of lowest order of v over c, then what we have here essentially is roughly, say, 1 plus 1 half v over c squared times one half v over c squared plus higher order terms. Again, here, the same thing. We have one plus v over c squared plus higher terms. And so this is roughly one half rho v squared plus rho epsilon, which you recognize as the Newtonian total energy density that we discussed a lot in the last couple of lectures. So again, here we have the kinetic energy density, the bulk energy of the fluid flow. And here we have the internal energy density E. And so, you know, in the Newtonian limit, we expect sort of tau to converge to the Newtonian total energy, and so and therefore also the as I'll show in a second, the energy equation to converge to the Newtonian analog that we already know. So the second remark is that, as I mentioned, here we see for the first time explicit geometric source terms. Arise on the right hand side. And the good news is they do not depend on time derivatives of space time quantities. So what is then done in practice is that essentially assuming a background spacetime given by some sort of metric G mu nu, you can compute the right-hand side, so these geometric source terms. So once we know the metric and we have specified a foliation, we can compute all the quantities on the right-hand side. So the spatial derivatives of, for example, of the three metric gamma ij, we can compute the extrinsic curvature and so on and so forth. So the right hand side, the source terms are all specified and well defined. And so then we can make, we can solve these fluid equations and we can update all the fluid quantities. And from there we get an update, a new sort of form of the energy momentum tensor at the next time step, which will then source, again, Einstein's equations. And then based on that energy momentum tensor that characterizes the fluid flow in the given space-time, we can update the space-time and get essentially a new expression for our space-time quantities at the next time step, based on which we can then again do such a fluid step here, plugging in the space-time quantities on the right-hand side and evolving the fluid again, to the next time step. And so in this coupled evolution setting of doing what we call a hydro step and then a space-time step, so alternating between these two sets of equations, we can then sort of numerically evolve the full problem, the coupled problem of space-time evolution coupled to hydrodynamics. And this is what we usually do numerically. So as in the Newtonian case, we also need obviously an equation of state to close the system. So also here, we need to specify an equation of state. So again, we need some relation of the pressure in terms of the other thermodynamic of these two independent thermodynamic variables, say the density and specific internal energy. And then depending on how complicated the microphysics are, we may have additional variables like composition and so on and so forth. And then one complication that arises here in the general relativistic setting that is not present in Newtonian hydrodynamics is the relation between conservative quantities and so-called primitive quantities. In Newtonian hydrodynamics, those relations, you've actually written them down on the first problem set. So I actually made you look at this conservative primitive transformation in Newtonian hydrodynamics. And it's essentially trivial there. You can write down analytic equations of how to compute and how to move from one set of variables to the other. But in GR, that is not possible. And so usually you have to do some nonlinear root finding to solve for the primitives given the conservative variables. Because what we numerically evolve are these conserved variables, so those that appear in the conservation laws. But then to update the energy momentum tensor, for example, or also to compute some of the flux terms at a given time step, we need to know what the primitives are, because those functions, those quantities are functions of the primitive quantities. And so we actually have to solve for the primitive variables at every given time step. Once we know the conservatives. And that turns out to be actually a really tricky problem. Since the relations between these quantities are highly nonlinear, and so numerically it can be tricky to find those variables robustly. And you need some, for these hydrodynamic codes and for numerical evolution, you need some robust, reliable recipe by which you can get these primitive quantities, because as I said, at every single time step, you will need to compute those. And that can be actually fairly tricky. So again, remember, these are our conservatives, so the conserved quantities that appear directly in the conservation laws. But what we actually often need is the set of primitive quantities, which is the rest mass density rho, the fluid three velocity v, and the specific internal energy epsilon, or sometimes you could also substitute that for the temperature, for example, for some other, depending on what you assume as independent thermodynamic variables in your system. So this is what is usually called the primitive quantities. So in order revolution, one must compute the set of primitives W. Oops. From the set of conservatives numerically. And this is how also the equation of state gets involved. And depending on how complicated your microphysics are, this problem can become fairly tricky and complicated. So typically, just to give you an idea, what one does is obtain W via nonlinear root finding. In some variables, so there's various schemes of how to do this. So let's say you have some, you do some root finding on some variable Z, and assume you can compute that variable Z from a set of primitives. And so you can then look at the difference. So essentially drive that to a consistent relation where you just look for a root of this function. So you look at Z estimated from the current evolution equations you have. You compute Z depending on a set of primitives that you can relate to conservatives. So let me maybe illustrate this with one specific example. So if you have, say, if we say iterate on the pressure, what we could do is it turns out so by some manipulations we can directly compute some of these primitives from some conservatives. Then compute the Lorentz vector from those velocity components. We directly get the rest mass density from the conserved density divided by the Lorentz vector computed in this way. And with this, we can write down the specific internal energy as the total energy density minus dW plus P1 minus W squared over dW. And in this way, we have estimated a set of primitives directly from conservatives that we know from the evolution step. Now we call essentially the equation of state and sort of some other relations that we analytically know. And we can, from those sets of estimated primitives, we can compute this variable Z, and in this case, the pressure. We compare it to what we had as a previous guess, and we can iterate on the scheme as long to make it converge, and end up in the end with a consistent set of primitives that are consistent with the set of conservatives given from the evolution step of the equation. So that is essentially the idea behind that. Shamelessly, I'll advertise here a previous paper of mine that actually looks at all sorts of different conservative to primitive schemes. So we implemented a lot of those, modified some existing ones, came up with new ones, compared those for sort of more complicated microphysics. And sort of showed which schemes work well, which schemes do not, and sort of made some recommendations there. So in case you're interested in that, is a reference to look this up. And so this is really the crucial difference between Newtonian and GR hydrodynamics. There's this additional complication that folds into these evolution steps. And then obviously, finally,
Daniel, can I ask?
Yes, sure. A
couple of questions?
Yeah, of course. I should maybe stop here and ask for questions and policy a little bit. Yes.
So a question I have is, so when you come up with the conservative form of all your fluid equations, Are there different ways of doing this, or is it a unique recipe that will give you, you know, the flux equations?
So you mean the 3+1 split itself? So you mean like the form of the
No. Equation? So I'm asking, are there different conserved variables that would also give you? So can you come up with different sets of conserved variables that will give you the same sort of form for the fluid equations?
Yeah, that's a good question. So in principle, yes. But what you would like to do usually is to try and find an analog of the Newtonian setting, where you have some sort of some notion of a lab frame, essentially, right? So where essentially you look at the system from an observer addressed with respect to what you would call the system. And so this construction of the Eulerian observer here is sort of the natural generalization of what you would have in as an Eulerian observer in the Newtonian setting. And so if you take that reference frame of the Eulerian observer, that essentially defines your set of conserved variables that lead to these conservation type form. So in principle, you could adopt a different observer, and end up with similar looking equations. But sort of interpreting this physically would become more difficult. So this is why, in some sense, this Eulerian observer is a special observer, or say a natural choice that directly leads to a given set of conservatives. Now you can, as I mentioned, in principle, you can play around with this a little bit. For example, I pointed out this choice of, or the zero point of the energy, for example, that you can sort of modify this a little bit, so to make sure that you recover the Newtonian limit of some of these quantities or things like that. So there's obviously choices there you can additionally make. But once you sort of choose your observer, essentially the set of equations or the set of conservatives will be fixed to some degree. Does that roughly answer what?
Yeah. No, it does.
What you were asking.
So the other question I had is that, so suppose that you don't like the idea of reconstructing the primitives from the conservatives. So if you wanted to stick with the primitive variables, you would have to give up on the flux form for the fluid equations.
Right.
So would that be a big disaster, or could you proceed with finite differencing based on the original version of the equations?
Yeah, that is a really good question. And so save that question for Thursday and maybe 1.5 weeks from now. So we'll show that if you don't take the conservative form of the equation, as soon as you get nonlinearities, so meaning shocks, you will actually get the wrong shock speeds and things like that. So there are in fact schemes where people try to evolve, for example, the Euler equation. So let's say the Newtonian Euler equations in non-conservative form. And you can easily show that that evolution actually leads to wrong results because as nonlinearities enter,
So the
your
issue
estimate
is that the right. So the original equations are not valid across shocks, whereas the flux, you know, the conservative equations can be made sense of
exactly
across shocks.
Right. Exactly.
That's the idea. Okay. Thank you.
Because across shocks, exactly, you would resort to the integral version, and so this is what will lead us to the concept of weak solutions to these equations.
Right.
And so you can show that, especially if you use finite differencing, where you assume that everything is differentiable, you will not find the weak solution. And so you will, if you find some type of solution, you will not converge to the correct solution of the equations that are the actual physical solution in the nonlinear case.
Okay. That's very interesting. Yep. So, yeah, I'll be looking forward to that.
Good. This is why I'm so concerned, essentially, about this conservation form. And this is why I sort of wanted to hammer this here a couple of times in this chapter, that essentially, for all sorts of equations we're looking at, we sort of have to be careful and try to massage them in such a way that we always end up with some conservative formulation of the equations. But all these subtleties will become hopefully clear in a few lectures from now. Once you look at this numerically. Okay, any other questions? So if not, I'll just continue here with this really quick note on hyperbolicity. So for those of you who have looked at the problem set, at the first problem set, by now you'll have shown essentially that the Newtonian Euler equations are strictly hyperbolic if the sound speed is non-vanishing. So in other words, if you're not in vacuum. And it turns out the same holds true in the relativistic case. So you can show that the set of equations which I've just derived above in conservative form are strictly hyperbolic if what we call the, so yeah, I should actually mention there are two limits. So one is obviously the vacuum limit, but the other one is the causal limit. So the sound speed has to be smaller than the speed of light, obviously. So if we are not in vacuum and the equation of state is what we call causal, so meaning that the sound speed smaller than the speed of light, so c squared. And it's just noted in this way. So this is sound speed. And obviously in the Newtonian limit, there's no causal limit to this because things are allowed to propagate at infinite speed. So if you're interested in, so showing this actually is a little more involved than obviously than in the Newtonian case. So I will not do it here and I will not expect you to do this as an exercise because that, again, there are sort of more sort of background details about the 3+1 split and everything is required here. So, but for those of you who are interested in showing these hyperbolicity properties, I can definitely recommend the book by Anil in 1990. There's also data papers who discuss this in the context of magnetohydrodynamics, for example, and show that also in the case of magnetohydrodynamics, these equations are strictly hyperbolic. I believe actually Anil also did this in the book. So this is Anton et al. APJ637296. Just in case for those of you who are interested, and you'll find both the hydrodynamic and magnetohydrodynamic cases there. And last, I just wanted to point out that these equations are, and this is also sort of part of the motivation of the Eulerian observer, that very naturally, in this form, you recover the special relativistic and also the Newtonian limit of these equations by essentially relaxing, in a sense, if you will, the foliation of space-time to Minkowski space. So the V tilde will sort of go to the actual three velocity VI in Minkowski space. And so then we're left with this set of conserved variables. And the fluxes read like this. And the source terms, the geometric source terms vanish. So as we would expect. And then sort of you can go one step further and then take the slow velocity limit, so the Newtonian limit. So taking a small velocity limit, so W goes to 1 plus 1 half V over C squared. Again, we can neglect the pressure contributions with respect to the rest mass energy. So we have a non-relativistic fluid. Specific enthalpy approaches 1. So remember, this was 1 plus epsilon plus P over rho. And so all of this essentially approaches 1. Also, epsilon will be much smaller than the rest mass energy density, so much, much smaller than 1. And tau, will go, as I already showed, will go to the familiar expression for the total energy density in the Newtonian case. So 1 half rho v squared, the kinetic, plus the internal part. And so what we'll end up with as a set of conservatives is, again, rho. So to lowest order in velocity in v over c. And you'll recognize this exactly as a set of conserved variables that we got in the Newtonian case. And also the fluxes of this equation relax exactly to the Newtonian expression. Rho vi, and then rho vi vj plus p. So this is the familiar version of the momentum flux density. Okay, and then we have E plus P VI, and then obviously the source terms are 0. And this is, again, if you compare this to section 2.2, where we derive the Eulerian, the Euler equation in the Newtonian setting, you'll see that that exactly matches those expressions that we found there. Okay. Any final questions regarding this? So I obviously have to admit much of this was sort of very hand-waving and using lots of shortcuts. So I apologize, but sort of the main point of this chapter was really to point out the conservation form of the GR version essentially given here. And sort of as the most important conclusion from this chapter, I wanted to point out that essentially, once you boil it down to this version of the equations, you can actually use standard methods for numerical methods for conservation laws, as in the Newtonian setting. So remember, if you look at these equations, essentially, if you don't know, say, about the interpretation of, say, some of these functions in here, like gamma or the extrinsic curvature, so this exactly looks like a Newtonian setting. So we've effectively transformed these tensorial equations in a four-dimensional space-time into something, into a set of coupled partial differential equations, strictly hyperbolic conservation laws in Rn, essentially. So those are essentially no functions in flat space. And so we can use standard numerical methods to deal with those. It's just that we have essentially additional source terms on the right-hand side. And this is how the space-time essentially manifests itself in this sort of flat space form of the equations, if you wish. Okay. If there are no questions at this time, in just the last 5 minutes, to wrap up this chapter, let me just really briefly comment on relativistic radiation transfer. And I will only be able to give a very brief summary in 5 minutes. Essentially, what I want to point out here is that, again, there's a general relativistic version of the Liouville theorem and the general relativistic version of the Boltzmann equation. And in the very same manner as in the Newtonian setting, you can devise a moment scheme to simplify essentially the Boltzmann equation into a set again of conservation laws, the so-called moment schemes, where again we can use numerical methods for conservation laws to actually get an approximation to radiation transport. And this happens this is possible in a very similar way, in a very analogous way to the Newtonian case that you will do on the second problem set. So some of you may have seen this problem already on the new problem set, where I'm asking you to essentially derive a moment scheme for Newtonian radiation transport. And so this concept was taken to GR by Thorne in a paper in 1981. So I pointed out on the reading list, it's again, none of this is really crucial for the rest of the course. I just wanted to point it out as an interesting as sort of an interesting concept, and which is actually very important for computational applications. So essentially, Thorne developed this moment scheme in the GR context. And based on that moment scheme, then later on people have written down sort of in a 3+1 space-time splitting fashion, as for the hydrodynamic equations, written down a moment scheme to get some approximation to radiation transport in the GR case. And so I'll just sketch this really, really quickly here. Essentially, Thorne has essentially just given an interpretation, or say the conceptual foundation for how to define such radiation moments in the four-dimensional space-time. And essentially, the idea here to look at is, say, at a photon trajectory, which I've, so this is the world line, say, of a photon in this space-time, and let's say we parameterize this by some parameter xi. And so then, let's say this is parameterized in such a way that the tangent vector to this world line is exactly the photon momentum, p mu, so the form momentum. And so for massless particles, again, remember that this has to be a null vector. And so this is a vector in sort of the local tangent space, where say this is point P here. And we can decompose this vector into, again, let's say we have some observer, some congruence essentially of observers that we define by this four velocity field U mu, and for now we keep it sort of very general. We'll not yet go into identify this as Eulerian observers in a 3+1 split of space-time, but just be very general for now. So then we have a tangent vector here that is along this observer. Mu, and we have a normal component to this jar call n and mu. And so we can decompose the photon four momentum p mu as minus. So this is the projection onto this general observer. And then we have a component normal to this. Okay. And so we can also reparametrize the photon trajectory essentially by the proper distance that this photon travels. And so I'll call this L, which is just sort of the integral over so measuring the, so dl is just the proper distance traveled by this photon. And then the idea is, again, that we have some, locally, we have some distribution function in phase space that tells us sort of locally how many photons we have in a given control volume in phase space. So this will again be our point in space-time. And this will be the four momentum. And this has to be on the light cone. So because P is a null vector. So this is essentially on the light cone, and so point in space time P, and then this would be in the corresponding tangent space. So try to draw this really quick. So if these are like our momenta axes, so if this is P0, then all our photon momenta have to lie on this light cone in momentum space. So we can actually, with this additional constraint here, we know that F essentially is a function of time, and then sort of our three spatial coordinates xi that we just keep very general for now, and then we have essentially just three momentum components as p0 determined by this light cone condition. And so then the idea is that we can actually write down the Boltzmann equation in terms of as a total derivative along the photon trajectory, dl. And so this is again df by dx mu by dl. And then with respect to the momenta components, and then on the right-hand side again, if there are interactions, if there are collisions, then there we have, again, some source terms. And so this is essentially the GR version of the Boltzmann equation. So you can read up on this a little more in the notes that I put on GitHub, so I'm not able to go through this in detail here anymore. So I just wanted to now finish by pointing out essentially that what Thorne did then was essentially to define moments of this distribution function in a very similar way. And as you can see here now, the equation almost looks like if you were in flat space, and if you would look at at the Newtonian, at the Boltzmann equation in a Newtonian setting. And so what he did is then to define, again, radiation moments in analogy to the Newtonian case, so moments of f of the distribution function, and derived these evolution equations for those moments. And then later on, if you're actually interested in the 3+1, formulation, then I'd refer you to Shibata, who I believe was the first one to write down an actual modern version of this in this 3+1 split of space-time. And so this is, I think, progress. So this is 2011, progress in theoretical physics. And there he essentially shows that taking this definition of moments by Thorne, going into a 3+1 split of space-time, you can derive, again, conservation laws for the first few moments of the general relativistic Boltzmann equation, and therefore get a coupled set of equations that you can actually, that under certain conditions, depending on closure relations and so on, are actually hyperbolic, and therefore you can, again, employ numerical schemes for conservation laws to solve these equations and to get approximate radiation transport in the GR setting. Okay, I should really stop here. I'm sorry to go a few minutes over time, but I had to wrap it up here because we really want to look into numerical methods and start to look at these problems numerically next time. Any final questions or thoughts? Yeah, I apologize. This was quite a rush going over over this in 5 minutes. All right, but yeah, if people have questions or so, I'll be on Zoom tomorrow for office hours. And if any questions come up in the meanwhile, feel free to ask them tomorrow. Okay. There are no final questions, then enjoy the rest of your evening and see you either tomorrow or on Thursday.
Thanks.
Thanks.